An evening of lively, smart conversation and jazz. Join me, John Williams, for a live taping of the Mincing Rascals podcast, Robert's Pizza, and Jazz, Wednesday, June 12th, 6 to 8 at Winter's Jazz Club in Streeterville. Tickets at WGNRadio.com/rascals.
Kelly Leonard returns to our studio. I describe him as the best storyteller in Chicago, and I think if it was a contest, he'd win it because that's what he does for a living. Hi, Kelly. How are you?
Hi, John. I'm doing great. Great to see you.
You tell stories and pass along wisdom that you've gained from Second City to businesses. Second City has not only the improv, but they also have a corporate arm. Which is bigger? Which would you say is more on brand?
Oh, no. The theater is still the biggest thing. Yeah. I mean, the corporate division is a lot of blue sky. You know, there's always different kinds of opportunities there. But at the end of the day, man, got to sell those tickets to the shows.
You and I were talking about shows, and you asked me how the Eagles and Steely Dan were, and I said, really good. And then you said you saw Roseanne Cash at the Old Town?
Old Town School, yeah. Amazing show.
How long ago was that?
It's just a couple months ago.
Yeah.
And my wife on the show night, she's like, I don't know if I'm up for this. And I'm like, it is going to be worth it. And then I turned to her during the encore, and my wife is weeping. So it's like,
you want to leave now, or shall we stay for the whole thing?
Yeah, it was amazing. And she, you know, she said she's not going to tour much longer. So really seeing her, and you can see, you hear so much of her dad, Johnny Cash, in her work. And but she is a distinct voice. And it was like piercing the heart of America, that concert.
You told me that he gave her a list of the songs she needs to know.
Yeah, so he had said,
I don't know this story.
Yeah, he said, here's your education, handed her a list of 120 songs that she was supposed to learn. And then she released an album, might have won a Grammy, called The List. And it was like 12 of those songs.
American standards? What were they?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Country songs, folk songs?
So the one that my wife was crying at was her closer. It was the extra encore because someone yelled out, will you do the song? And she said, okay. And it was called 500 Miles. And Anne remembers her parents, who were very involved in like social justice stuff, singing that like around a campfire. And it was just so, it was so primal, right, in terms of a memory for her. It was a lovely, lovely concert and a reminder in terms of the amazing culture that we've got in Chicago that people need to get out and see shows.
Yeah. And music can do that too. Can really transport you, can't
it? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, it's just funny because I wonder if Johnny actually did that and meant that. That is, you don't have to go to college. If you know these music, that'll be an education. There was a guy whose son, this is just a true story, but he wrote a book about it and I interviewed him, so I only know this much about it. But his kid didn't want to go to school. He was in high school. And he says, okay, I'll let you drop out, but we are going to see a movie a day and talk about it.
Hmm.
And imagine all the life lessons and wisdom you could gain if you both were good about it. But he said that they were. And then it's the story of the movies and the lessons that they learned.
So my wife started a thing with our son called the Sunday Night Movie Club when he was in grade school. And when my kids went to Chicago Waldorf, which is pretty much they don't want you doing a lot of media. But we did this one thing. So on Sunday night, they would watch Dr. Strangelove, The Graduate, Apocalypse Now, Tootsie, you know, all these movies. And to this day, Nick's reference level is that of a 57-year-old man.
I was just going to say, Kung Fu Panda wasn't out yet. I mean,
yeah, no.
And who picked the movies when you all
and did? And it was stuff
your wife
that,
did. Yeah,
yeah. So that she wanted to sort of either revisit or, and in some cases, like they watch Trading Places, doesn't hold up well. Does not hold up well. But other things like Harold and Maude absolutely do.
So when you are out speaking, now you went to Toronto recently, right?
Yeah, last week. It was a Future of Work Learning and Development Conference.
That was the title of it, The Future of Work?
It's two conferences. There's one was Future of Work. The other was Learning and Development. I had spoken there last year, and then they were bringing me back. And I'm not a stand-up. I kind of have my thing that I do. And they said to me, it was only 20 minutes. They're like, could you do new material? Like, what am I going to go try? There's not clubs for this. Like, I'm not going to go to the economic club and say, can I test out 20 minutes?
Well, plus, if you're talking about the future of work, and this is the future of work, that's the future of work.
Yeah.
It hasn't changed in the last 12 months, or maybe it has. I don't know.
It's always changing. And one of the things that I do talk about is storytelling. And I always start my talks with a story. Now, I have a sort of stock story about my son that I tell with these things, and I did it last year. So I needed to do a new story, and I got one.
Okay. I got time.
Okay. I'm going to test it out on you. Well, no, I tested it out on them. It went well. So it's 1996, and we're in Ireland, and we're in a van with a bunch of Second City alumni, and we're lost. So we're there for this Cat Laughs Comedy Festival, International Comedy Festival, and Joyce Sloan, who had set this up at Second City, gave it, as opposed to like the current cast, gave it to a bunch of alumni. So in this van is Bill Murray, George Wendt, Tim Kazurinsky, and Dan Castellaneta. Do you know who Dan Castellaneta is?
I know the name.
He is the voice of Homer Simpson.
And so, when did this event take place in the van?
96.
Keep going.
1996. So completely lost, and see a older Irish gentleman with a cane pull over to the side of the road. Bill Murray says, hey, we need to get to the Cat Laughs Comedy Festival in Kilkenny. I think it's called the Cat Laughs Club. Can you tell us how to get there? And he just goes, ah, the Cat Laughs Club. Well, I wouldn't start from here. So that didn't help. So we get to a petrol station and get the right directions and show up. And so this is an all improv show. And we're doing a thing at the end called a conducted story. And in the old days at Second City, we always ended the shows with this. And it's where the audience yells out suggestions of authors. Each actor takes that suggestion and they tell a story in the style of that author down a line. So trading off. So someone yells Enid Blyton, and Tim raises his hand because he's from Australia because no one else knew who Enid.
No kidding.
Yeah. So children's author, wonderful, took that. So everyone's getting their authors. Oh, and I should mention this. One of the things that happened when George Wendt got out of the van is people started yelling Norm at him. Norm. And he did a thing under his breath where he's like, it's George. It's George. And Tim Kazurinsky actually took him aside and said, I think you need to reframe this. I think they love Norm, and there's a lot of George in Norm. The reason they maybe don't love George is they don't know George. So maybe you take that. And actually, that was a thing. That's a note that Tim gave George that he did take, which was really important in terms of that character followed him forever. So they're doing the conducted story. The only person who doesn't have an author is Dan Castellaneta. And someone from the audience yells, Homer! And he's like, look, I didn't come across the pond to my TV character for you. And the guy yells in the audience, from the Iliad, you git! So Dan Castellaneta realizes in this moment that he's completely screwed this up. And so they start doing the story. When it got to Dan Castellaneta, he did Homer Simpson doing Homer from the Odyssey and
nice.
Iliad, and it brought the house down.
Nice.
So three reasons I told that story.
What's the moral of that story?
Three reasons. One is the power of storytelling as a communication tool. You want to make instant connection, get your audience laughing, tell them real stories of things that happened with real human behavior. The importance of actual deep listening. Understanding that people behave in a variety of ways that you might be projecting on them. And the importance of being seen. So that's the thing with George, which is like, look, you're seeing this as kind of an insult. They're seeing it as an appreciation. Maybe you need to change your frame of reference and everything will be okay. And it was. And finally, like resilience in the form of making mistakes work for you because they're inevitable. The mistakes are going to happen. So Dan screwed up and thought the guy was talking about one thing when he was talking about another. And he could either let that defeat him or he could turn it to his advantage, which is the thing that great improvisers do.
Is what you're telling us something I use in the business world, or is there a sort of day-to-day interpersonal use for all of that?
I will answer yes. And the reason I say that, Mary and I were just talking about this in her office, which is every business problem is probably a human problem. I mean, there are systems and other things that are involved, but most of our interpersonal stuff that goes on at work is interpersonal stuff. It has to do with the way you're brought up or where you're from or what your mood is that day. It's like things don't change suddenly when you walk into a business that people are different. It's like, no, they're people. And so the more we can understand things like psychology, sociology, neuroscience, all these history, regions, the way someone, we were just in Atlanta visiting our son Nick, who's living down there now as an actor, and people in Atlanta are different than people in the South are different than they are in the North, and behaviors are different. And that's the case across the board. And I think one of the things that's a problem in business training, and this is something Second City provides solutions for, is that people get caught up in their MBAs when maybe they need to be concerned about simple how human beings work.
I don't know if this reflects on that, but every now and then I'll read a statement from the mayor's office or the corporate arm, communications arm of a corporation, and it doesn't sound like the way people talk.
Right.
And that bugs me because they're using all of these phrases and words that are very buzzy in their world, but they just sound so manufactured, you know?
Yeah, the business jargon has got to go. You know, if I have to talk about ROI one more time, I don't know if I told you this. So EBITDA gets tossed around a lot by people in, you know, money circles. I can't even, it's an acronym for something in terms of earnings. And it was being said a lot at Second City at a certain point, and I got annoyed by it. So I made hats for everyone on the leadership team that said EBITDA as my nod to maybe let's...
We don't need to say it anymore.
We can talk about other things.
By the way, are the people that are really good at improv, is that a science or an art? Is that innate or can that be taught?
Both. It has to be taught. So you could... It's the same as a professional athlete. So just because you pitch well, you need that mentorship, right, over a period of time to become a great pitcher. And it is the same. Stephen Colbert walked in as a very good actor and a witty improviser, but he left Second City being an expert. So there are some people who, you know, get in and they're good, but they don't progress. Again, just like classical music or sports or any sort of performance of that manner. So it is not just innate, though,
some people have more natural talent.
Yeah, obviously. Some people walk in funnier. Some people walk in with better acting chops. Some people
walk
in... Do you
tell some people no thanks? I mean, I guess not everybody gets on stage, but I wonder, right? But
you
have
to audition to get into our conservatory. So we have beginning classes that anyone can take.
Okay, so there it is. And I wonder if that's kind of a sad business, because maybe every now and then Stephen Colbert walks in, but a lot of times it's people like me who think they're real funny and they're not, right?
I mean, well,
and you know, you take their money, they paid for the class, they're going to learn what you teach them, but maybe they're never going to be a pro.
Yeah, no. I mean, and even the conservatory, so let's say there's 120 people in the conservatory program at any given time, we're only hiring like 3 or 4 or 5 people a year.
Oh, really? From that conservatory class?
From anywhere.
From an audition. So they may walk in off the street.
Yeah, I think it's often that the conservatory program, you do that and you probably have a couple of years of rooting around like anything, you know,
really?
playing it at the different theaters that do this work. And generally by that time, if you got it and the timing's right, you can get a slot at Second City.
In your podcast, Getting to ESN, you're talking to Cal Newport, who wrote a book called Slow Productivity. What is this?
So Cal's a professor of computer science at Georgetown University, and he's also a founding member of the Center for Digital Ethics. We didn't get into that, but I'm interested in that idea. So this is a radical idea that he's presenting in this book, and I think it is correct, which is in knowledge work, which is the kind of work that a lot of us do when we go to our office, if we're sitting at a desk, let's say that's our work. There is no clear scientific evidence of productivity. All right, so we understand productivity from the agrarian revolution, let's say, like when we start doing agriculture, rotating crops. We understand it from the industrial revolution in terms of assembly lines. But when we go to work in our offices, how do we know if we're productive or not? Because we're there 9 to 5? Because we answered emails?
What's the metric?
What's the metric? And there isn't one. And in fact, that's a serious problem, because it means that maybe we think just showing up means we're productive. Maybe we think scheduling a bunch of meetings, which of course we know is not productive in terms of any brain time whatsoever. And so first, this book is about, hey, this is a reality. Try shooting some holes in it. You can't. There is no measure for productivity. So what do we do? Because the default, of course, is that we each decide ourselves how we're best productive. And I don't know that we're the best judges of our own selves in this regard. So the book is really about that. And then he has some good hacks about this stuff. And he says in the book that his two big suggestions are reduce the number of tasks you schedule and reduce the number of appointments in your calendar.
So you're going to work harder at fewer things?
Yep.
By the way, I guess the caveat to all this is if you're in sales, there's a metric. It's dollars. It's
well, it doesn't. And for comedians, it's laughs. So it's sports is really easy. Any of those kinds of things. There are places, but again, for the other person in the office, let's say you're not on a quota for sales, because most heads of sales are not on a quota. How do we tell you're productive? And even someone who's really good at sales is like, are they necessarily being productive?
So you have, he talks about hacks?
Yeah, so he has a really good one. And I gave this, my friend Colleen, who I work with, is someone who's, she's the head of marketing at Second City, but she's a catch-all for a bunch of different things. And her calendar is atrocious every time I try to open it up and schedule something. So one of the hacks he says is if someone wants to schedule a meeting with you, you send them your calendar so they can see what it looks like and where they would fit in. And immediately, if you go there and you see that this person is overscheduled the way they are, maybe you're going to take a second and not call that meeting or make it a 15-minute meeting. Or, you know, and so being protective of your own time and recognizing you have some agency around that is really important to safeguarding your productivity.
Hmm. I just was reading a book this weekend about boundaries, and the woman said that you need to set boundaries, and that manifests itself in a lot of different ways, but some of them are what you just described. Protect your own time.
Yeah.
If your calendar is that full because you're accommodating everybody, start accommodating everybody. Just say, you know what? I don't have an hour for you. I've got 10 minutes. I don't know if that's what you were saying.
Sure. That's it. And I actually have a very interesting thing on boundaries. So, of course, I wrote the book called Yes And, the podcast called Yes And. So I'm actually very interested in no. I'm very interested of where we use no. I just read the study. One of the authors is Vanessa Bonds, who's been on the podcast. And essentially, the study they did was they grabbed a group of individuals who agreed to the study. And for the first group, half of the group, they said, all right, hand me your phone, unlock your phone, hand it to me. I'm going to take it outside and do some stuff. If you don't want to, you can refuse, and it won't affect your payment or your participation in the study. So that's half the people. The other half of the people, they did the same thing. Give me your phone. Unlock it. I'm going to take it outside, do some stuff. If you don't want to participate, this is what they said, say these words, I'd rather not. The people in that part of the study felt way better about saying no. And the idea here is that saying no is kind of a social shame. We just say yes to things all the time. So to protect our boundaries, if you want someone to protect their boundary, give them a script.
Huh.
And I thought this was so interesting because I'm like, improv is about being scriptless. Improv is those places where we are collectively making something out of nothing. But our work isn't that all day long. It can't be. That would be exhausting. So a bulk of our day is trying to accomplish these different tasks. And we'd probably get better at that if we were given a script where we could say no.
Hmm.
But it's really hard at work, right, to be the, you don't want to be the no guy.
I told Pete I want to continue this conversation. He said, I'd rather not. You have to wrap it up. It's nice to see you, Kelly.
Touche. Thank you.
Kelly Leonard is the Vice President of Creative Strategy over at Second City. You can reach him and have him do what he does for you at secondcity.com.